This episode of the Sit Down is powered by Thrive Fantasy. Are you into props? Do you like betting fantasy football? Are you ready for football? Thrive Fantasy has you covered. With Thrive, you can eliminate the countless hours of research and focus on only the top tier athletes that have the biggest impact on the game. Who the hell wants to worry about bench warmers and that kind of stuff? We can worry just about the top tier guys. And if you love props, this is definitely for you. What you do is you choose 10 out of the 20 available player props to build your lineup. Each prop is assigned a fantasy value for both the over and under based on how likely it is to hit. You hit the most props and you rack up the most points to win big shares of prize pools. Keep in mind, Thrive Fantasy has over 140,000 guaranteed in prizes for NFL Week 1. NFL Week 1 is coming. We're about a month away from the NFL season. And Thrive Fantasy wants to award you with over that and a ton of money as the season gets going. Thrive also features 100K guaranteed contests, and it's just $20 to enter, and first place takes home $20,000. I urge you, if you enjoy the Sit Down, if you enjoy football, go check out a brand new app, Thrive Fantasy, and if you use promo code Sit Down when you sign up today, you're going to get 100% instant deposit as a bonus. Up to $100. So if you put up $100, they're going to give you $100 and you can play that for free on Thrive Fantasy. If you like player props, I love player props. It's a sport app for you. Don't do the general, just fantasy apps. Go check out Thrive today. Get in the game. Again, promo code Sit Down when you sign up today and you receive 100% instant first deposit match up to $100. Get involved. Thrive Fantasy. Football's coming.
Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody, and welcome in to another edition of The Sit Down, an organized crime podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Nadeau. Hope you're having a great day. We are back, another show, another episode, another sit down. We have a gigantic show tonight, and I know my co-host is all excited about this one because you know, it seems like every week, you know, it always comes back, and we've done a lot of Gambino people lately, and it always comes back, and we haven't done a Mr. Neal show, and you wouldn't believe it, but I get so many DMs. When are you going to do a Neal show? When are you going to do a Neal show? When are you going to do a Neal show? And I know my co-host, Blackjack Fletcher, he's been looking forward to this because he's told me on occasion that Neal De La Croce is his favorite mobster ever. So we got a big one. We're going to do a Q&A as well. Let's welcome him in. Blackjack Fletcher, how you doing?
I'm good, buddy. How you doing?
Doing great. Doing great. Good to hear from you as always. Really excited for this one.
You said it. I love Mr. Neal, Father Neal. I love it. Very excited for this episode. I just think that Neal De La Croce is the epitome of the American mafia. If you could sum it up in one guy, it's him.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I have kind of an interesting way of thinking about Neal. You know, I don't think you have John Gotti without Neal. I really don't. You know, I think if Neal weren't around, John would have been killed. And I mean that.
100%.
You know, I think, you know, we kind of look at two different gangsters in the Gambino crime family, one of them being John Gotti and the other being Roy DeMeo. When we did the Roy show, we kind of talked about it. No one ever really fought for Roy, right? He never really had anyone that fought for him ultimately. And he went off the deep end and really his undoing. I mean, John did a lot of shit that was out of pocket. I mean, he killed Ralph Gayon. They were selling drugs. Like, I think Neal really centered a lot of that stuff and said, you know what? I think of this guy like a son. You can't kill him. And I think he went to bat. You know, DeMeo didn't have that. So I think without Neal De La Croce, you don't have John Gotti. Yeah. Neal lived a really fascinating life. And I think the word for Neal is pragmatist, right? You know, yep. He's a guy that you know, really didn't rock the boat. He was always going to play by the rules. And as we say, you know, I don't think they make them like Neal De La Croce, you know?
I don't think they make men like Neal De La Croce, let alone mobsters. I think he's a dying breed, maybe already extinct. I don't know, but you're absolutely right about John Gotti. I mean, John Gotti gets clipped without Neal De La Croce multiple times, right? I mean, you said the Gayon thing in and of itself gets Gotti taken out.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. And We'll get into that in just a little bit, but we're going to do a Q&A to get started here. We got a lot of great questions this week. I have about 20 questions. So, you know, people have responded, people like this, people like to hear their voice heard. And, you know, I think the audience likes it. So let's kind of get into it. But Blackjack, football got started. You're excited about that. Obviously sports betting and the mob go hand in hand. And I'll tell you this, and before we get into the Q&A, we're talking about football. You heard the advertisement at the beginning. You got to go check out Thrive Fantasy. And I mean that. Week one NFL, they got $100,000 contest. Who doesn't like fantasy? Who doesn't like props? They put it all together and really take all the hassle out of it. I use this app. They're the official app of the Jacksonville Jaguars. I love this app. Check out Thrive Fantasy. Go tell them the Sit Down sent you. Are you excited about football, Blackjack? It's coming up. We've got just a few days.
Football gives meaning to my weekends, right? It's like you know where you're going to be and what you're going to be doing. It just gives a certain structure that I crave. So, yes, I'm very excited.
Couldn't agree more. Also, if you want to ask a question, you want to get involved with this each week, and you're not following us, that's probably why you're missing it. Make sure you check us out on Twitter, @TheSitDown7. I throw a little post out every week. Hey, if you have a question, shoot it out. And, you know, we also put out a lot of cool facts and things like that. So make sure you give us a follow on Twitter @TheSitDown7. Also, check us out on YouTube as well. The Sit Down and Organized Crime Podcast is on YouTube. I put out some stuff there that I don't talk about on the show. I do some things called Sit Down Shorts where I kind of look at a smaller mobster or an event that happened. We've done some already. We do some live shows, interviews, that sort of thing. So make sure you check us out on YouTube as well. Let's get into the Q&A. We'll start it out with Jersey Girl 713. She says, do you think Sammy would have cooperated if the tapes weren't heard?
No.
You know, that's a great question. Because I think when it really come down to it, I think Sammy was a true blue gangster, but he's also a guy that I think made it clear he didn't want to go to prison. I'm sure he'll tell you that he wouldn't have, because that's his excuse for cooperating. He'll say, well, you know, John was going to, you know, get rid of me, or John was talking subversive or whatever. Look, a lot of mobsters talked about other mobsters. That doesn't mean that, you know, some were willing to talk about people, but they weren't going to kill him because they made too much money. I think Sammy just didn't want to go to jail. He did crimes and he didn't want to do the time. I think the tapes obviously made it a lot worse, but I think he would have cooperated either way.
I don't think he would. Okay. And the reason I say that is, number one, you know, it's easy to say, yeah, John was talking subversive, and he was. Let's be honest here. John Gotti, at this point in his reign, was starting to get paranoid, right? I mean, I think that's fair to say from the tapes that he was doubting a lot of people. And he was doubting Sammy Gravano in a big way. I think you could make a very strong case that he actively tried to take out Sammy Gravano during this time period. I don't know that Sammy was necessarily, you know, afraid of going to prison. I don't know. I mean, obviously nobody wants to go, but I don't know, with John Gotti being who he was and his record of pulling rabbits out of the hat with the government, for lack of a better term, I don't know that he flips on him. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating question, and I think it's a, you know, I'm glad she asked it, because it's, and again, he has a YouTube channel. I'm sure you can get him to tell you that he wouldn't have, but I'm not necessarily buying it. I think he was just a guy that, you know, didn't want to go to prison, and, you know, that's ultimately why people cooperate. They don't want to go to prison. So I think you have two different answers here, one of which, you know, is, you know, who knows? I don't know. We'll never know.
Speculating here, you know, but
someday I hope to ask him and hope to get the real answer out of him. So, you know, we'll do that someday. Charles Martel, and this question's interesting, and I know Charles. I've talked to him before. He's an intellectual. I know that. And he went really deep with this. I always wondered if Frankie Three Fingers Coppola and Joe Beck Di Palermo knew each other. I know they knew Lucky Luciano, and they're both elaborate heroin dealers. Did any of their business coincide? For anyone who doesn't know, Frank Coppola was an individual that, as Charles said, he was a heroin trafficker. He worked really in Detroit. He came over from Sicily. And in his late 20s, he settled in Detroit, really started working among Detroit and St. Louis to sell heroin. He was a big-time drug dealer, knew Jimmy Hoffa. He was very close with big people. Now, DiPalermo worked for the Lucchese crime family. He was also a big heroin dealer. Do I know if they ever interacted? I don't know. That's a good question. Obviously, ultimately, each family, whether it's St. Louis, Detroit, whoever, the head of the mafias were in New York. However, St. Louis, you know, those areas kind of reported indirectly to the outfit. So do I know if they ever, you know, kind of coincided business? I don't know. They weren't big enough, like boss wise, they weren't going to interact. Like a lot of the bosses interacted with other bosses. I don't think though, like different dealers are interacting. I don't know if they ran into each other, you know, in the 40s or 50s or whatever. That's a good question. I don't know. My guess would be no. Kurt, have either of you read Lucky Luciano's semi-autobiography, The Last Testament? If so, what did you think? Interesting insights or exaggerated self-promotion? Great show. Thanks for the hard work. You know, one thing about me that a lot of people don't know, and I don't know if even you know this, Blackjack, but I'm a avid reader. I have a ton of books. I'm actually right now reading a book about Vinny Bassiano. I have not read the book from Lucky. It's on my list. I definitely want to get to it. A lot of people have asked me, you know, when are you going to do a Lucky show? And I'm kind of saving that one. He's obviously a huge heavy hitter. So I'm waiting for something particular to happen. And if that happens, that will be our first episode. So he's coming. Have you, you haven't read that, right, Blackjack?
I have not. I have not. But the second part of the question is, you know, was this, are these like gems or are they self-promotion? I'm just going to say that in my view, anybody who has written an autobiography features some element of self-promotion, right? Part of the purpose of writing that book is because you want things seen from your point of view. So there's always going to be an element of self-promotion in those things.
Yeah. And from what I understand, it's quite good. I have to get it. I know, I think at one point I looked it up and it was like $90, the book. So I have to try to find it, but I'm willing to pay because I'd be fascinated to read it. I think sometimes with books, I think you really have to do some research on the author, because when it comes to books, there are books that are not truthful. For instance, you know, John Ayler wrote a book recently. It wasn't truthful. Philip Carlo wrote a book about gas pipe Casso. It was not truthful. So I think you really have to know. And you know, some episodes, one of the episodes we'll do, I'll kind of share who I enjoy reading, the authors I enjoy and I think are credible. But I haven't read it, but I'm going to. If you have, I'd like to hear what you think of it. Benjamin. Says, hey guys, love the show. Thank you. He says, my hometown of Bradford, Pennsylvania has been referred to as Little Chicago. I've heard a lot of mobsters came through this area and Capone may have even shot someone there. Curious if there's any truth here or you know anything about my town or heard stories. To answer your question, I do know about Bradford. I'm obviously from Pennsylvania. Bradford is a town up near New York. It's near the border. And the reason I know about Bradford is my best friend is in prison. He actually was at FCI McKean for a period of time. And he kind of told me about the area. And, you know, I do know that there is some mob connection to Bradford. I know back in the 20s, that was kind of a big hub for Prohibition. It was kind of one of those types of areas in the middle of nowhere that was just big with it. And I know that Al Capone did have some run in there. For instance, if you know where Bradford is, Blackjack, it's up near the New York border, not far from Erie. And it's within, you know, a couple hours of Pittsburgh, northeastern Pennsylvania, Buffalo, all these different mob hubs. And I feel like Bradford definitely was probably a spot. I've definitely heard it referred to as Little Chicago. So, yeah, I don't know a whole lot about it. It's been so long since anything happened there. But, for, you know, weirdly enough, not only was Bradford very important in the mob in those times, but a city called Olean in New York was as well. And Olean is synonymous, at least in my world, with college basketball because it's where St. Bonaventure is.
Yep.
And that was also a big town as far as Prohibition was concerned. So, yeah, you know, it's interesting because you have all these little areas that, and I know in the city I live in now, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, there's a town not far from me called Marietta. And I did some digging a few months ago, and I found an old 1990s commission report from the state of Pennsylvania criminal commission that they were doing a outline of criminals in Pennsylvania. And there was reports that back in the 30s and 40s, the Buffalino crime family had all sorts of businesses in Marietta and had associates and made men that lived in this area. And, you know, when you really pull back the onion, most areas in the Northeastern areas have had some sort of mob connection in some way. So it's kind of fascinating, Blackjack, to think about.
It is. And you're right. When you get into the Northeast, a lot of these little towns that maybe you wouldn't think of have some tie in some way. So yeah, it's interesting. We start talking about these small towns.
This is a great question. John Jackson, do mobsters from places like Dallas speak with a Texan drawl? Hard to imagine, isn't it? Only New York really works. Yeah, look, to make this kind of clear, Dallas was the only real mob stronghold, at least at any point. And Dallas was kind of run by Carlos Marcello. I know Jack Ruby was obviously from Dallas. Jack Ruby is actually originally from Chicago, so he didn't have a Texas accent. Look, were there associates maybe that owned places that were connected with the mob? Not only did they have Texas accents, but I'm sure some had, New Orleans accents as well. But obviously Marcello was from Italy. He didn't have an American accent. Were there some associates that maybe did? Probably. But I don't think any big hitters had Texas draws. None that I know of. I think the only people that would have had those would have been maybe Dixie Mafia or we talked about on our Twitter page, the Cornbread Mafia in Kentucky. I don't know of any Italian mobsters that had a Texas draw.
I think it's just you have whatever accent you grow up with. I don't know if that changes.
And back then, like New Orleans was so big back in like the 10s, the 20s, the 30s, and then the Marcello times. And those guys were all from Italy directly. So they're not going to have the Texas accents. Yeah. But I'm sure there's someone out there. All right. Sean Reed. These are some great questions, by the way. Was there naturally a night where you would take your wife out for dinner and also a night for your gumadas, like in Goodfellas? Did made men say those nights are off limits to kill a mafia member when he was with his lady? If no, can you name a hit that happened on a date night? What wild question. As far as was there a day for girlfriends? I don't think there was a day set out that all mobsters like adhered to. I don't think it was like the Holy Sabbath or something where, you didn't do stuff. I think the gumadas for most guys, they just went to them when they could. I know Chin Gigante had a separate family. One lived in New York and one lived in Jersey. And you just saw them when you saw them. Do I think it was like Goodfellas? No. And I think that's where Goodfellas kind of lost the plot. Like that didn't happen. They didn't get treated like they do in prison. Like a lot of that stuff didn't really happen. But as far as do I know of any situations where a mobster was killed or killed someone with his wife or girlfriend there? The only one that I could remember would have been Joe Gallo. Yep. I don't know of any, like, I think it's conceivable to think that a lot could have happened. Like, would it have been wild to think that when Albert Anastasia was killed, that his wife wasn't sitting there waiting? Not really. Do I think it's happened? Probably. Generally, the mob in this country stays away from involving family members. But I think this is only synonymous with the American mob, because if you look at cartels, you look at street gangs, you look at the Italian mafia in Italy, it is, and I think a lot of people don't understand this, and I think you kind of will get where I'm going here, Blackjack. When an individual that's part of the criminal life, they're supposed to be killed, the contracts that are taken out on them are on site. It doesn't matter where these people are. If you see them, kill them. Doesn't matter who's around. That's how it works. Okay. So when someone says, I can't believe they did that in broad daylight, it's like, well, yeah, again, it's not about broad daylight or night. It's when you see these people, you kill them. It's that simple.
Most hits are not Paul Castellano, where it's organized like an assassination.
Yeah, exactly.
They're usually, as you said, if you see him, take him out, and it doesn't really matter who he's with. You're right, though, that the American mafia has generally shied away from involving families. And the example you gave, the cartel, is the perfect example, right? The cartel has no problem taking your family out with you.
Yeah.
So, I mean, not just doing it in front of them. So, I mean, there is a little bit of a difference in philosophy, I think, with the American mafia. They tend to try to do things that don't involve families.
Yeah. again, as far as I know, there's not a ton, but you know, Blackshear mentioned the cartel. I mean, you know, the Ndrangheta, the Camorra, I mean, they're going to do the same thing. I mean, they're going to blow your house up. They're going to do whatever they
have. That doesn't matter.
Yeah. So, yeah, the one I would think of would be Joe Gallo. Joe Gallo, you know, his wife was an eyewitness for sure. All right. This is a great question. Lost Soul 85. Would the Mafia have been as prolific without Prohibition?
That's a good one.
You know, and this is one that I did see and I thought about. And, you know, I think on the surface, it's like people would lend to believe that no, it wouldn't have, but I'm not so sure. I mean, we have to remember Prohibition really wasn't that long. It was only like 10, 15 years. And if we remember during Prohibition, the Mafia was making all sorts of other money before Prohibition, during Prohibition, and after. So like Giuseppe Morello, the Five Points Gang, all these different groups were already making money. And then after Prohibition, they made money. So the Mafia was always able to adapt, and whether it was the Black Hand and extortion or drugs or whatever. Do I think it definitely helped? Surely. And it created things like The Outfit and other stuff like that. But I think the Mafia would have been just as prolific without Prohibition. It's a great question to think about.
It's a great question. And I think ultimately you're probably right. But I think the best way to look at Prohibition for the Mafia is it was rocket fuel for them, right? It was an accelerant. It just took these organizations that were making money, as you said, but now you went from making money to making real money, right? Like now you're making serious money overnight in doing this. And I think it probably accelerated their trajectory more than anything else.
But you look at, you know, and I always go back to this, like Big Jim Colosimo, who was killed because he didn't want to go into Prohibition.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a really rich man, you know, before Prohibition. Yeah. So it's like there was other vice, there was other things going on. I definitely, as you said, I think it streamlined and made, you know, another income stream. Prohibition was kind of what labor racketeering became. Like it was the same kind of level of prolific. So I think it would have lost soul, you know, but I guess we'll never really know. Rank the five families in terms of power and status from the heyday to presently to the best of your ability. Love the show. Thank you, Nick. Appreciate that. That's easy. Genovese, Gambino, Lucchese, Bonanno, Colombo.
Yep. I don't think there's really any argument there.
And I'll be frank. I would probably put Chicago above
Colombo.
I'd put them above probably Bonanno and Lucchese as well.
Yeah. I mean, the thing there that you really struck on is that it really is Genovese, Gambino, and then everybody else, right? Like there's a clear top echelon. Those two guys are the SEC and everyone else is, you know, the rest.
Yeah. It's, and that's a great way of putting it. You know, Genovese and Gambino are the SEC, the Big Ten, Bonanno would be like the Big 12. Lucchese Colombo would be like the ACC and Pac-12.
That's really what it boils down to is you've got two powerhouses here and everyone else is jockeying, you know, for position.
And look, someone asked me the other day who I think I was doing. I was on the train and I was doing a Q&A. Somebody asked me who's the most prolific boss now. And it's like, if you know the Mafia, there's one person, and if you know who I'm talking about, he's a current boss. He's just light years better than everybody else. So, and I'm not going to go into who that is. You can search that for yourself. Nope. But, you know, he's been around and he's super powerful. All right, next one. SB, hi Jeff and Blackjack. If Gotti wasn't pinched and put away for life, and assuming he stayed out of jail, what would that have meant for the mob? Him being a household name, and what would have possibly happened to him? Love the show from the UK. Thanks, man. Appreciate that. Well, look, John wasn't going to escape jail. I mean, it's that simple. As far as if he wasn't pinched and put away,
someone would have killed him.
Chin would have killed him. Probably.
If John Gotti's story does not end with him dying in his bed at home, like it just doesn't.
No.
If he's not in jail, somebody takes him out. The story ultimately doesn't change because John Gotti was a figure that just was not. He was a star that burned bright, not long.
Could you imagine, though, if he were still around? Like, he'd be like 90. That'd be wild. I mean, do you think he would do like a podcast? I feel like he would. Like, he seems like a guy.
I think John Gotti would have the best way I can
describe been an actor
in my mind, and I don't know, Jeff, maybe you'll agree with this, maybe you won't. He would have been a Donald Trump type person. I think John Gotti would have been a celebrity.
I don't
in this day and age of reality TV and people transitioning from all walks of life. Yeah. John Gotti would have been a Donald Trump like figure.
Yeah, you got to change with the times. That's a good point. It's a good point. To answer your question though, he wasn't going to escape going to jail. It's just that simple. You can't beat the government that many times and eventually just beat them and they go. To be fair, Jeff,
Gotti knew it. He said how many times, I'm either going to die in a cell or you know, I'm going out in the box. Like exactly. He knew what was coming.
Exactly. Fire the Cannon, shout out to you. I know you're a big fan of the show. Columbus, shout out to you. Any known gangsters from Columbus, Ohio? I know Cleveland, Youngstown were swarming, but unsure of Columbus. Thanks. This kind of goes back to what we said about Bradford and some of those areas. Columbus definitely probably had a presence. I don't think there was a pronounced presence, but we have to remember the Midwest was full of smaller areas that had a mob presence. A lot of people don't know this, but Madison, Wisconsin had a mob family. You know, Indianapolis had a presence. You know, obviously Cleveland, Pittsburgh, all these different places. West Virginia, we talked about. So do I think there were some connected people in Columbus? Sure, 100%. And look, back in the day, like the 1900s, 1910s, the Black Hand was very pronounced in Columbus. So, to answer your question, there were a couple. This is a great one as well. Do you know of any mafia athletes who were the top three? I had to think about this one because, you know, we obviously know about Chin. He was a great boxer, fought Madison Square Garden, actually won. There were a couple. I know Nicky Scarfo boxed at one point. I don't know that he was very good. I know John Martirano up in Boston. I know he was a pretty good football player as far as I know. I don't think he was anyone like he didn't go to college for it. Trying to think of who else.
I think you're the boxers are really the ones that come to mind because
Al Capone, he was a great baseball player.
That's true. That's true. But a lot of these guys didn't go to college. So, I mean, there's not really, you know, a huge track record of it. I mean, Tommy Patera was a good athlete.
Yeah. Right? Karate. It's a good one, actually. I didn't think about that. I consider karate a sport. I mean, it's an Olympic sport, judo, that kind of thing.
The guy had to be a hell of an athlete to do what he did.
100%. I think he still probably, you know, can cut your eyes out from you even without a knife. So, yeah, I think that's do I know of any that played like a traditional sport like basketball or football? Not that I know of, especially not the big people that we've talked about. Joey Messina wasn't playing basketball. I know.
Yeah.
I know that. Would have been a good football player, I'd have to imagine.
The
ones they're kind of offshoot sports, whether it's karate or boxing or Joey Merlino was a horse jockey, the great Joey Merlino. A lot of people don't know that. He actually Blackjack, did you know that?
I did not.
He actually raced at present day Parks Casino. There used to be a place called Philadelphia Park years ago. He actually won. He was a good jockey. No,
I was just trying to picture Joey Merlino riding a thoroughbred.
He's a little guy. He was a little guy back then. No shit. This is not no bullshit either.
I believe you. It's just funny to think of.
I'll have to send you a picture. There's a picture from the winner's circle of him on a horse. I'll have to send it to you. You're a big horse racing guy, so I can't believe I didn't tell you that. Lorenzo, do you know anything about Gallo crew member Joe Musumeci? I don't know much about him. What I would recommend, Lorenzo, if you want to learn about him, reach out to Frank DiMatteo. Frank has done some interviews. He wrote a book about the Gallo crew. He grew up around them. He's kind of the foremost authority on that. So I would go check him out. He did an interview with Vlad TV, wrote a good book. So I would ask him. I'm sure he probably knows. Larry Mazza as well. Colombo guy. All right, let's do one more. Might be too much of a question instead of a dedicated post, but can you give a brief history of how the Mafia transitioned from Italy to the United States? Who were the players? What were the rackets? Yeah, you know, we actually talked about this on a previous show. We talked about Giuseppe Morello, who was the first real known individual to bring organized crime to America. He was from obviously Italy. He was from Corleone in Sicily, and he was part of a group that beefed with the Castamolari's group. And he comes over, finds and founds the 107th Street Mob, which is presently the Genovese family. And he was kind of the first real known starter. Obviously, he had Paul Kelly and, you know, even people like Carlo, who came over kind of in the early 20s to escape Italy. And as we know, Italy was like really royalty when it came to the mob. As far as how they transitioned, I mean, they really just did like the Black Hand and that kind of thing. But I would look up Giuseppe Morello. We'll probably do a show on him down the road. He was kind of the real originator of the mafia and kind of the mafia in this country. And I know in the book that one of the commenters mentioned earlier, The Last Testament of Lucky Luciano, he believes, the individual that wrote that book, he believes that Lucky actually orchestrated Morello's death, as far as I know. So, yeah, it's a fascinating start. And that's the cool thing about this show, Blackjack, because even the show we're doing today on Neil de la Croce, it all kind of culminates because we've done Carlo and Paul and John. And, you know, it all kind of, I think if you can look back at the history, Morello was the first kind of start of all this. So we'll do a show on him down the road. But really great questions, guys. That was enjoyable. That's what makes the comment and Q&A fun, when you get great questions. So shout out to you guys for that. Blackjack, what do you say we get into Emilio de la Croce?
Do it.
Before we do that, though, I want to tell you guys about OmertaMia.com. A lot of people have contacted me and said, hey, Jeff, that shirt you're wearing with Al Capone at the baseball game, or the Stop Glorifying Rats or whatever, where'd you get that? I got it at OmertaMia.com. And if you like and you live by a code like a lot of people do, I'm not going to say I live by the code, but I have ethics and I live by a certain way. And if you live that way and you like those phrases, I would highly urge you to go to OmertaMia.com. They've got hats, they've got shirts, they've got cups, they've got stickers, they've got artwork, they've got all sorts of things to keep you threaded out. And I get so many comments on those shirts, so I would highly recommend going to get one. I know you like it, Blackjack. And I'll tell you this, one of the things I love about OmertaMia most is you get the clothes quick. They're great products. They're not going to fade after a wash or two or three. They're well-made. They're great. And you're going to get a lot of head turns, I'll tell you right now. And if you go to OmertaMia.com right now, that's OmertaMia.com, you're going to get 20% off just because you listen to this show. We have a relationship with them. If you enter code SITDOWN20, SITDOWN20, all one word, you're going to get 20% off your total purchase, and you're supporting the show. You're supporting them. They're friends of ours. Make sure you go check them out. Blackjack, I know you like OmertaMia.com.
I love it. I love it, man. The shirts are great. They also have more than that. They've got really, really cool wall art. I mean, they sell coffee. They sell a lot of different
stuff. I have a mug, by the way.
Yeah, they've got really cool stuff on that site. If you haven't checked it out, go check out OmertaMia.com. There's a lot of fun stuff on there. You're going to find something you like.
Yeah, you know you're getting older when you enjoy getting coffee mugs. I have one now, and I love it. So shout out to OmertaMia for that. They sent me a cool little bag. We got to get you a goodie bag, by the way.
We need one.
I've been saying that. So, yeah, go check out OmertaMia.com. And by the way, I'm actually working with Chris, the owner of the company, and we're getting some shirts that I want made. So one of the ideas I had, Blackjack, was Salerno on a shirt, which is coming. So I might have my own special shirts. So stay tuned. So yeah, go check that out. OmertaMia.com, code SITDOWN20, get yourself 20% off your order and get involved. All right, let's get into Neil de la Croce. The much talked about Neil de la Croce. Emilio John de la Croce was born March 15th, 1914. He was born in Little Italy in Manhattan. And his mother and father, Francesco and Antoinette, obviously came over from Italy and settled right in Little Italy. Neil would grow up at 232 Mulberry Street, just down the street from the present day, or not present day, but the old school Ravenite Social Club, right between Spring Street and Prince Street. Literally the center of Little Italy. That was where Neil was from. That was his neighborhood. And in that time, it was heavily controlled by the mafia, heavily controlled. It's not like it is now where, you know, there's hippie coffee shops and all sorts of stuff. back then, blackjack, Little Italy was Little Italy.
Yeah, I mean, it was, as you said, like how you described it, not, you know, coffee shops. It's true. It was the hub for Italian Americans in New York City. I mean, that's obviously where the name comes from, but it was their enclave in New York. So if you were an Italian in New York, that's tends to be where you migrated towards.
Yeah, and weirdly enough, the Della Croces didn't have a big family. Only had two kids, Neil and his brother, Carmine, who would actually follow him into the life as well. As we know in communities of the time in New York, whether you're Irish, Italian, whatever, work wasn't easy. And most of the kids wouldn't go to high school. They would just kind of leave and go get a job somewhere. As a young teenager, Neil would work for a butcher. He would try to take a straight job, but it didn't really work. By 16, Neil was, stealing things. He was committing petty crime. He was beating people up. He was doing what he had to do. By 1930, Neil had already been arrested for petty theft, for other low-level crimes. And I think he had really walked out of his house, and it was so easy. And I always kind of bring it back to the Bronx Tale because, you know, when Calogero would walk out of his house, he would see people like his dad working, but he would also see the guys that were really getting on in the neighborhood, and those were the gangsters. And I think Neil, like any kid that we've talked about, did that. He started fighting. He started hurting people. He started robbing businesses, petty theft. It was like any other kid in the time. And, you know, it's funny because when Neil was growing up, I think he was bullied a little bit. A lot of people would call him the Polack because he didn't look Italian. He didn't have the Mediterranean features, didn't have olive skin or the black hair. He just kind of looked like an Irish kid or something. I think Neil kind of was someone that grew a pretty hefty exterior pretty quick. And, you know, it's interesting to think about because I always thought of Neil as kind of like a silent killer. I don't think he was real imposing. I think he was just one of those guys had a unwavering stare, as we've talked about. And I think he really learned quick how to defend himself. You know, and really as a young, you know, kind of 20-year-old, he gets the attention of the Mangano crime family, which down the road would obviously become the present-day Gambino family. But, you know, a lot of these guys that were coming over from Sicily really kind of wanted these young guys that they could teach the ropes, become affiliated to. And, you know, Neil was kind of one of those people, Blackjack, for these families.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, as you said, you know, Neil tried to play it straight when he was a teenager, but that didn't last very long. And what do? You know, you're growing up in Little Italy in this time period. It's very easy to fall into some money, especially you've got to consider, Jeff, we're talking, you know, 1930, 31. I mean, the American economy was not good. It was not good, right? So we're in the midst of the Great Depression. We're coming off of World War One. And yeah, this is an easy way to start putting some money in your pocket. And Neil was a guy who, as you said, may not have been the most physically imposing guy. He was a guy who was very, very serious and was willing to do whatever he had to do.
I think the thing about Neil, and which was kind of interesting, a lot of the guys that we talk about, they're not real big guys. And we talk about Galanti, he was kind of a short guy. Patera was small. You know, Father O'Neill, he was called, he was 5'10". I mean, he was, you know, 200 pounds. He was a pretty big guy. You know, he was tall. You know, wasn't, and not the 5'10s tall, but he's taller than most of the guys we talk about. He was kind of an imposing guy.
Well, certainly for that time, he was the tall, I mean, they referred to him as the tall guy at points. But I mean, he wasn't a guy who was, you know, built like some of the guys we've talked about. Neil could walk around and just be a normal guy.
Yeah. And again, as he's continue to learn kind of a lot of the rackets and things of that nature. He's coming up under the Mangano family. Neil starts, you know, committing assaults. He starts committing murder. In one instance in 1937, he's committed to prison for 6 months after he's arrested for felonious assault. Keep in mind, at that point, he's only 23 years old. So, you know, this is a guy that really started to get involved. And, you know, by this point, their rumor has it is he's killing people. And one of the things that Neil was always kind of smart with is he was able to kind of blend in. Right. And there was a story that at one point Neil would dress as a Catholic priest and walk around Manhattan really to try to throw people off. He didn't look like a mobster anyway, but this really threw people off. And according to mob lore, he allegedly once committed a murder while wearing the Catholic priest outfit.
I mean, that's, first of all, it's badass. Yeah. Second of all, it's brilliant, right? I mean, you talk about, we talked about Chin Gigante walking around in a bathrobe acting like he's crazy. Walking around like a priest is a beautiful play if you can get away with it. And Neil got away with it for a long time. I mean, there, you know, you read stories about him talking to police officers and things while he's dressed as a priest.
Yeah.
You know, and just having like casual chats. It's a hell of a disguise.
Yeah. And by the late 30s, Albert Anastasia was the underboss of the Mangano crime family. Albert Anastasia was doing his thing. Neil would become affiliated with him, kind of work under him. By 1951, as we know, the longtime boss of the Mangano family, Vincent Mangano, disappears. And down the road, he's ruled dead. This was Anastasia's way to become the boss, not be bled to death, take control of the family. At that point, you know, Neil continues to rise. The problem that Neil had was, at the time, Neil was working under a guy out of Mulberry Street called Armand Reva. Reva was in control of what was called down the road the Mulberry Street Crew. Obviously, 1957 was a big year in the mob. In October of 57, we all know what happens. Carlo Gambino decides he's going to take control of the family. And in 57, Joe Biondo and Carlo Gambino order the hit on Anastasia. He's killed at the Park Sheridan Hotel. Keep in mind, 1 month later, Armand Reva, who ran the Mulberry Street Crew, and from what people say, was a heavy loyalist to Anastasia, he was killed as well. And a lot of people believe Neil was the one that did that piece of work. Once Reva was out of the way, Neil would actually share the Mulberry Street Crew with another guy called Anthony Rizzo. And I think I want to kind of talk quickly about the Mulberry Street Crew, because when we really look back at the Mulberry Street Crew, it's fascinating how the Gambinos were able to build so many solid groups. And the Mulberry Street Crew is one of the more powerful in the mafia. They had literally people everywhere, everywhere in the city, including Carmine Della Croce, who is Neil's brother. He worked as kind of a debt collector and an enforcer and would eventually make a lot of money. There were guys like Eddie DeCurtis. Eddie DeCurtis was a big time earner for the mafia. He was huge in porn, gay bars, porn films, all sorts of stuff. He also had a bookmaking operation, dice games, crap games, card games, all sorts of things. He was a big time earner. People like Carmine Fatico was part of the Mulberry Street Crew. We know Carmine from obviously East New York. He was the guy that really kind of grew up John Gotti and Quack Quack Ruggiero. And that's how obviously they would get to know Neil. Keep in mind also Fat Andy Ruggiano, Vincent Iacono, Guido DeCurtis, you know, all these different guys, Eddie Consalvo, all these guys were part of the crew. And it was one of the more powerful in the city. And Neil was running it. Little Lily was his blackjack.
Yeah. I mean, listen, that's a sharp rise for Neil Della Croce, you know, from a kid who was working as a butcher not that long ago. But your point about the Gambinos being able to put together kind of these, like, you know, super crews is really well taken, because even later in their history, they still continued to do it, you know, where you had these different crews in different rackets bringing in massive amounts of money. It really is something that I don't know we've seen other families do as often or as well as the Gambinos did.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously other people that he would interact with, there was a guy, Joe the Cat LaForte. LaForte was when I say gigantic real estate investor, Blackjack, Joe the Cat bought into Little Italy before it became what it is now. And from what I understand, was a very rich man. He literally, I mean, he was buying up all sorts of property, and think of what it cost then and what it costs now.
Yeah.
It was pretty wild. And Joe the Cat actually owned the building that Michael Cirilli lived in, who was part of Neil's crew.
Really?
And yeah, they actually, obviously, LaForte owned the Ravenite Social Club. And people don't know this, but the Ravenite actually had been in the family and in the mafia for years. back in the day, Lucky Luciano used to go by the bar, and it was actually at that time called the Alto Knight Social Club, and it was a big place to go during Prohibition. Eventually, Carlo Gambino would take it over in kind of around that time he took over the family, and he named it the Ravenite because his favorite poem was The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe. So the Ravenite was a longtime haunt for the gangsters in the Gambino family, and it really goes back to Lafort and him owning it and it kind of being something that was passed down. So a little bit about the Ravenite social club. By 1965, Carlo was in control of the family, and there was a big problem developing in the family. Joe Biondo, who was really a prolific gangster, he was the underboss in the family. Joe was part of the coup to eliminate Albert Anastasia. And a lot of people believe that his brother was the individual that carried the head out. By this point, Joe was in poor health. He was also becoming an outcast in the family after something went wrong with the two, and he was kind of playing both sides of the fence with other families. So he was in poor health. Carlo kind of just said, we're not going to kill him. Let's just let him shelve and go away. And he leaves the family. He ended up dying in 1966, so it didn't last long. At that point, Neil De La Croce would become the underboss of the family and would really kind of ultimately serve there forever. Obviously we know Paul would come in and be involved as well, but I think you and I could both agree, Blackjack, that Neil and Paul were the underbosses. They were kind of joint.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how you can really make a distinction between the two in terms of their power and control within the family. Neil and Paul were, you know, one and one A.
Yeah. And you know, by this point, Neil was a very rich man. He had moved kind of out of Little Italy, which, you know, Neil spent, he was kind of like Salerno in a way. He spent a lot of time in Little Italy. Obviously, down the road, he would move out to Staten Island. He would live at 597 West Fingerboard Road in Staten Island, had a beautiful house out there. He would, at this point, be married. He married Lucille Ricciardi, and they would have a son called Armand. Who would actually get into the life as well. And we'll talk about him in just a little bit. In 1966, this isn't talked about much, but I was like bringing it up because Neil was part of this. In 1966, obviously we know about the original Appalachian meeting, but in 1966, obviously the mob needed to meet, the ruling board needed to meet, and they set up what was called Little Appalachian, and they had it at a place called La Stella, which was a restaurant in Forest Hills, Queens. And it was really a who's who of mobsters there. I mean, Neil was there, Carlo was there, Joe Colombo, Carlos Marcello, Trafficante, Frank Gagliano, Mike Miranda. I mean, all sorts of people were there. And Neil actually was arrested for being there. They were eventually charged with contempt of court for refusing to testify to the grand jury investigating the meeting. And yeah, that's the whole thing with Neil. And people wonder, how did the mob for so many years get away with what they're doing? Because nobody fucking talked. Okay. Like it's,
dude,
we talk about time and time again. Like if there's no witnesses and if there's nobody talking, they can't catch you on anything.
It is rule number one of anyone involved in any sort of criminal act. Don't talk about it. Just don't talk about it to other people, certainly not to the police. Don't do anything. Just sit and wait. It'll usually be okay.
Exactly. And, you know, by this point as well, not only was Neil a tough guy on the streets, he had people, you know, doing things as far as, you know, drugs and all sorts of different things, loan sharking, bookmaking. But Neil was actually involved in legit business as well. He was part of a beverage company, a bottling company. He was listed as a salesman. He also had some, you know, heavy stock portfolios as well. And they would actually come back to haunt him. In 1972, Neil, weirdly enough, is indicted for tax evasion. From what I gather, Neil had over 20,000 shares of a stock in a company on Long Island called Yankee Plastics. And he was extorting them basically for no-show jobs in a way. And he was jammed up for tax evasion. And in 1993, the jurist in the case would call him a, quote, top-level hoodlum, a dangerous society, a menace to the community, and a parasite who lives off the lifeblood of honest people. And I bring this up because we've all seen The Wire, and I often wonder if David Simon took that quote. And if you remember when Omar was on the stand and Levy was questioning him about robbing drug dealers, and he says to him, "You're a parasite who leeches off the lifeblood of the honest people in this city." And I always wonder, is that a, I love to ask David about that, because it's kind of interesting. But when you look back at Neil, like, he was a dangerous guy, not only in regular society, but on the streets. He was a real parasite who lived off the lifeblood of honest people.
I mean, yeah, he was. I mean, Neil was no angel, even though he pretended to be a priest at times. You know, the quote, though, I mean, let's be honest, it has to come from that, right? I mean, it's too nuanced of a quote to just be coincidence, right? I mean, it has to come from Neil's case.
Yeah, I really wonder about it. Keep in mind, after that soliloquy from the jurist in 1973, Neil would be sentenced in that tax evasion case, and they hit him hard. I mean, you know this, Blackjack, a tax evasion, you generally get like 6 months, 8 months. You know, Neil got 5 years.
Especially for evading taxes on $112,000 worth of capital gains. So, you know, I don't know what the cap gains laws were in the 70s. I can't imagine they were higher than they are now, which is what, 40%. So, I mean, you're talking about 45, 50 grand, and you're doing 5 years in prison with no record. That's a stiff, stiff sentence.
Keep in mind, for most of Neil's life, that really wasn't a big problem. He lived into his 70s and he did about 5 years. So not real bad. So Neil would go away. And during his prison stay, he got kind of jammed up in something else, or at least he thought he got jammed up in something else. In 1974, a guy called Charles Kalish was found in a trunk of a car in Yonkers. He was shot 5 times in the head. And this would set off a chain of events that would really bring Neil to the brink of possibly life in prison. So this guy, Kalish, was a bookmaker and a loan shark for the Gambino family. And he actually worked closely with an individual called Anthony Plata. Plata was known as Tony Plate, and he worked out of the Bronx, Blackjack. So what the Gambinos did in the 70s, the 80s, they were starting to send people from the family down to Florida to kind of plant the flag in Florida and say, we're growing territory down here. Fat Andy Ruggiano did it. A lot of families are doing it. A lot of Gambinos are doing it. And Tony Plate was a guy that went down there. Once he left, Kalish started kind of doing his New York work. They were kind of connected with each other. A time would come where Kalish starts to become a bit of a problem, and a lot of people thought he was an informant. He had gotten messed up with something, and Neil would make a decision to, quote, eliminate the Yonkers problem. It would turn out years later that Kalish was an informant, so the worry was true. Keep in mind, Kalish would be found shot in both eyes, each ear, and directly in the mouth, which was a sign that he heard too much, saw too much, and talked too much. So it was kind of that Sicilian message, right? So this would become a problem for Plata and for Della Croce, because Della Croce was obviously the capo regime and kind of the guy in a way that he reported to. He wasn't the capo, but he was the guy that Plate kind of reported to. In 1979, not only was Plata charged with a racketeering case, but so was Della Croce. There were other criminal counts, including the Kalish homicide, which it wasn't good. By this point, Neil had gotten out of prison, but it was going to put him right back in. Neil, though, was smart enough, Blackjack, as we know, no body or no person, no crime. You have to eliminate witnesses, which we've talked about on multiple shows. Neil would kind of eliminate Plata because he was the link between everyone in this case. He was the link to Kalish, and he was a guy that could cooperate. So what does Neil do? He sends a couple people to go see Plata in Florida. And a lot of people believe that the two people that went and killed Plata were Ruggiero and John Gotti.
I mean, if he was going to send someone to do a piece of work that was important, John's the guy he was sending, right? I mean, John Gotti was almost like a son to Neil Delacroce. He was certainly his mentor. I think we can both safely say, Jeff, that Neil Delacroce was the one man that John Gotti wouldn't cross.
No, I couldn't agree more. And keep in mind, Andrew Ruggiero was related to Delacroce. That was his uncle. So, you know, I think, again, and we go back to Ruggiero and Gotti, they had a lot of people sticking up for them. The biggest one was Delacroce. And Delacroce had a lot of respect, garnered a lot of good, and he was able to save them in a lot of things. And I definitely believe these were probably the two that went down to kill Plate. So look, at this point, Neil was good. The jury would deliberate for 3 days and return a verdict of not guilty. So Neil would skate. And this is what you have to do. Okay. I know it's like fixing a jury or killing a witness. The mob knew that if we could pay someone off or kill them, we're going to get off. That simple.
Yeah. I mean, listen, you're right in that there are certain ways around criminal prosecutions if you have the money and the, you know, physical tools to do it and the wherewithal, that there are ways around it. You know, I mean, John Gotti is a perfect example. He did it how many times in his life? You know, you find a way around. You get rid of witnesses or you get to a juror. And, you know, that goes back to our Q&A. One of the reasons I don't know that Sammy Gravano would have testified, because John Gotti was going to do whatever he had to do to try to get to a juror. And we've seen it over and over and over in history, whether it's, you know, mob trials like Gotti or, you know, or some of the other guys we've talked about, or the cocaine cowboys down in Florida. If you want to get to a jury, you'll find a way.
Yeah, exactly. And I wanted to kind of talk a little bit about Neil's personal life, because I think for us, when we do our shows, you know, we always try to tell you something that maybe you didn't know about somebody or whatever. And I think the personal life of Neil's was kind of interesting, and I'll tell you why. So Neil had a gumata called Shannon Connolly. Now, Miss Connolly was actually married to an individual in the family called Ernesto Grillo, and that she had a relationship with not only Neil, she would down the road also have a relationship with Senior as well. It was kind of odd. And a lot of people believe, and again, this is not me, this is strictly what I've heard. Miss Grillo would have a daughter. And during taped conversations at one point, John Gotti would reference this girl to his brother. And this has been a big tabloid thing. A lot of people thought about it. A lot of people wonder, did John bore a love child from a side piece? And this young girl, Miss Grillo, she's obviously a grown woman now. I've seen her. She does strikingly look like John. It's kind of interesting. And look, the Gotti family would obviously talk about this and kind of talk it down. But do you know anything about this story?
I mean, I've heard what you have, the rumors about, you know, the Gotti love child. But ultimately, we're never going to know, right? I mean, it's never going to be a thing. The Gotti family is never going to consent to any sort of DNA testing or anything like that. So it is what it is, Jeff. It will live in the lore of rumors. It's, you know, rumor and innuendo. It'll be there forever.
Yeah, and keep in mind, during a 1990, and this is kind of interesting because, again, Shannon Connolly originally was with Neil. During a 1998 wiretapped conversation between John and his brother, Peter, Gotti would say, she's a precious little kid. She's a nice kid. Cute kid, huh? Peter would respond, I thought she, and he would kind of say, I thought she was your daughter, referring closely to the raven-haired girl resembling Gotti's offspring. She's a nice kid, Gotti said of Grillo, who's now a dental hygienist student in New York. And I guess the girl at one point was referred to as Gangster Grillo by her friends. And a lot of people wondered, you know, I guess John didn't have any flattering things to say about the mother of this woman, Connelly. He called her, quote, a pee-pee brain. So I just found it interesting that John talked like that, called people pee-pee brains and stuff.
Pee-pee brain. That's not the language you expect out of John Gotti.
No, not at all. Not at all. Keep in mind as well, the Gotti oldest grandchild, Victoria Albano, would say in court at one point that I don't care if it's true or not. It doesn't change who he was to me. So it's kind of an interesting connection here. So who knows? Gotti would also say, I haven't seen her in over 7 years. She was a precious little kid. So maybe, you know, it all comes back from Neil. And it's weird, though, that Neil, once Neil died, that he kind of had a relationship with this Connelly woman. Kind of weird. Kind of a weird seven.
It's definitely odd that you would, you know, take your mentor's girlfriend and make her your own. But, you know, to each their own, I suppose, Jeff. You know, I mean, people grieve differently.
Yeah. It's definitely an interesting wiretap if you've ever heard it. So back to Neil. By 1980, we obviously talked about this in the Galante show last week. Galante was going nuts. He was, you know, at one point he was killing Gambino people, which kind of connected it to Neil. And the Manhattan DA was trying to stall the probe. And, you know, Neil was kind of involved with this. They wanted to talk to Neil. They wanted to talk to Bonanno people. They wanted to talk to Gambino people. They wanted to know what happened to Galante. A lot of people knew that he was up to something and they wanted to talk to them. By 1984, the feds would come calling again. They would bust Neil on income tax evasion. And, you know, this would really get close to the end for Neil De La Croce. He would obviously also be one of the individuals in the Gambino family that was charged at RICO conspiracy and related counts in the commission case. So, you know, and obviously down the road, we know what happens there. Paul gets jammed up as well. The defendants in that case would include John Gotti, Ruggiero, Carneglia, and other people. It really wouldn't matter, though. Neil would never serve any prison time for this. By this point, Neil was very sick. He had heart disease. He had cancer. And, you know, really would signal the end for Mr. Neil. On December 2nd, 1985, Neil was obviously sick in the hospital, and he would die of cancer at age 71. I know Blackjack's crying right now. He would be buried at St. John's Cemetery. So it really went kind of quick for Neil. He was really facing a lot of uncertain future. But I think, I guess I'll ask you, you would agree that Neil obviously would have just went away like Corallo and Salerno, and he would have died in prison.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there was any way around it. I mean, that those indictments, brother, were ironclad. I mean, they weren't messing around there. I don't think he stood any chance. So, you know, in some ways, obviously his death is sad, as are most deaths, but, you know, at least he didn't die in prison.
Exactly. And, you know, interestingly enough, during that last commission case that the Gambinos had, one of the individuals that was charged in that case was someone called Armand De La Croce. Armand was the son of Neil. Sadly, in 1988, De La Croce's son Armand would go into hiding. He was trying to, you know, he was convicted and he was out on bail, but he didn't go to sentencing, and he was on the run, and he would go to the Pocono Mountains. In April of 1988, Armand De La Croce would actually die as well from a cocaine overdose. So kind of a sad end for the De La Croce family. It seems like Armand really had a real problem, and you know, he was on the run. He was probably bored, started doing his cocaine, and before you know it, he did too many. I think that we'll remember Neil, I think, and I'm sure you'll agree, as being, as I said, a pragmatist. That's a great way to put it, but he's a guy that really was never willing to ruffle feathers. He could have been boss. He could have followed Gambino and Anastasia and all the guys that took what they wanted. He probably could have killed Gambino and Castellano and took over the family, but he was not a guy that was going to do that. He was one of the last of his kind, Gotti wasn't going to adhere to these rules. A lot of these people didn't adhere to the rules. He was a guy that did. He was an old school guy. He played by the rules. And if he never became boss, well, it is what it is. And I think when it comes down to respect and doing it the right way, I'm not really sure if there's a boss or someone that I can think of that had this high of regard that was like Neil. I think he was truly kind of one to another. And as I said, I don't think on any level, and this goes back to the question that someone asked us before, what would have been made of John? I think John would have been killed many years earlier if not for Neil. Yes.
John Gotti never becomes boss. He never kills Paul Castellano. He never makes it that far. But two things that you just mentioned. First, Neil Della Croce was a gangster's gangster, right? He was a guy that other guys respected. He was a guy that did it the right way his whole life. He lived by the code, okay? You talk about Omerta with Omerta Mia and things like that. He lived by that code. There was no wiggle room in it. That was how he lived. The other thing is you talk about John Gotti. Neil Della Croce was the only man who kept John Gotti in line. John Gotti was a wild man. He was a loose cannon. The only person that kept him in line was Neil Della Croce.
Yeah. And, you know, again, I think without Neil, I wonder kind of where I think, you know, the Gambino family, I think, could have really spiraled out of control. I mean, and it ended up kind of anyway, but, you know, I think Neil was kind of the glue for a long time because Paul was out of control. I think Neil was kind of the driving force in kind of making a lot of things kind of whole. And, you know, he was a great consigliere. And I think he would have been a great boss, you know, at any rate either. But, you know, Neil knew how to make money. He knew how to hurt people. He ruled with an iron fist. He was from the streets. But he was also someone that, you know, wasn't going to just make a problem if there wasn't one. And, you know, I think he was the best of really both worlds. You know, you have people like Paul who were great moneymakers, but they weren't in the streets. And, you know, Neil knew how to make money, He was involved with all sorts of things. I mean, if you know anything about Neil, he was very much into the into gay bars, to porn, to all sorts of things. He had money everywhere. And he was a guy that, when we go back and again look at the guys that truly succeed and are high level mobsters, they're earners and they're killers. And Neil was both. If you can find me someone that was more respected ultimately and didn't make any waves over him, I'd like to hear it. It seemed like every mobster you talk about, they have this streak in them where they need to be boss. They need to be powerful. Neil didn't care. So,
no,
I don't think you'll,
Neil cared more about the rules and the survival of the family than his own personal power.
Yeah, 1,000%. 1,000%. So there you go. A truly, and by the way, I don't think we have to share it again, the whole quote about his stare, but I'll share the picture when we post this episode. There's that one picture of Neil where his eyes are just, I heard a quote about, and I'm trying to remember where I heard of this. I think it was Joe Coffey, maybe. He made a comment, I think, about Neil at one point that, have you ever seen, like, I think Children of the Damned or Children of the Corn?
Children of the Damned.
He had those, like, he looked like one of those people in that.
He had the quote, because I have it in front of me, is, Della Croce's eyes were like he didn't have any eyes. Did you ever see Children of the Damned?
Yes.
His eyes were so blue that they weren't even there. It was like looking right through him.
Who said that? Do you know, Fan?
I don't. It is just attributed to a reporter.
Okay. Yeah, and I heard someone say, like, he was the scariest guy he'd ever come across.
A federal prosecutor said that he liked to peer into victims' faces like a dark angel at the moment of death. His eyes had no color, as if his soul was transparent.
Yeah, that's That's haunting, man. You know, I don't think he truly liked to kill people. I just think he, you know, he was did
good
it.
At it. I think he was good at it.
Now, obviously, we'll end this show on, you know, this would kind of set off a chain of events. Keep in mind, Neil died December 2nd, 1985. The hit went down December 16th. So 2 weeks to the day after Neil dies, Paul was laid out in front of Sparks. So you know, now again, you have to wonder, does this have, you know, anything to do with the fact that Paul didn't go to the funeral? Look, I don't think it was out of the question. Paul, listen, Joe Mussina didn't go to funerals either. I mean, again, we all know what mob funerals are, and Paul was obviously very high profile, but this would set off a huge chain of events and really be the end. I mean, I think Neil was probably, outside of Paul, the last true blue old school gangster that they had outside of Gotti. I mean, most of the other guys folded after this, but
for sure. And yeah, I mean, listen, I don't think that Paul going to the funeral would have stopped the hit. I don't think it would have delayed the hit. If you believe anything that comes out of the mouth of Sammy Gravano, he says this was in progress for quite a long time before Neil died, that they were just waiting for him to die.
Right. So, yeah, and look, 2 weeks after, I mean, they put the hit together that quick. I mean, that's pretty – not that it wasn't already being talked about, but – so there you go. Neil De La Croce. Just, you know, he's not going to, he's going to be your, you know, when you look at like a March Madness bracket, he's your like really solid, like five seed, you know, he's not a number one seed. You know, he's not a Cardo or you know, Lucky, but you know, Neil De La Croce was a top 15 mobster of all.
Yeah. Time. I mean, and you're right. You know, we've talked a lot about college comparisons. Neil De La Croce is like the four or five seed that can make a Final Four run.
Yeah, he's that good. I don't think, you know, again, he, and we relate this quickly to the Sopranos. You know, Silvio Dante was like a really powerful guy. Like he had great ability, but I don't know if, and like, again, I think Neil would have been a good boss. I think he probably would have been a better boss than Paul. But I think he was just fine the way he was in leading the way he led. So
it's a great comparison to Silvio, because Silvio was the guy who never really wanted the big seat, but I think everyone respected him. And when Tony had his issues where he was being threatened, I think you could look at it and say, well, Silvio probably wouldn't have had that problem.
Well, I'll say this. If you asked me a question of, if you could live the same life as any mobster, who would it be? I'll tell you, the people I'd pick would be Accardo, for obvious reasons. Salerno, just because he made so much money, and Neil, because I don't know, like, if I were in the mob, I wouldn't really necessarily want to be the boss either, because I know I can make a lot of money and still have power and not be the boss and deal with all the bullshit, where I can just kind of chill and, you know, make my money and still be powerful, but not take all the bullshit. So,
I mean, that's the thing, Jeff, you know, it's the old saying, heavy is the head that wears the crown.
Right.
And exactly. Neil skated on most of that. Like you said, he lived to be an old man and he only did 5 years in prison. You know, that's a trade. If you're living that life, you sign for that every day of the week.
100%. So there you go. Neil De La Croce on the show. As always, we thank you for listening. Make sure if you're new to the show, you hit the subscribe button, leave us a comment, leave us a review. Even if you're not new to the show and you haven't done that, please do it. It definitely helps us in the algorithms and things of that nature. And again, just a thank you for listening. We're coming up on 300,000 listens for this show. We should hit it with this one. So, it's been a great ride. I love this show. I love talking about it. I love doing it. And, you know, we really wouldn't, I think when you have people that listen to it and they love it, it makes you want to do it even more. So, I'm really glad we could have this journey together, Blackjack. I don't mean to get lame or corny, but.
No, brother, I say it all the time. This is my favorite hour of the week. I always learn something. It's fun. It's a topic that I'm interested in, you know, and it's enjoyable. It really is, you know, to kind of delve into these interesting lives that people have led. So it's a great show. And we thank all of you for listening and commenting and sending your questions. We couldn't do it without you.
And as we get more and more into every person every week, we continue to try to see all of this come together. And eventually, you know, it's funny. Someone said to me, did you ever think about doing the show kind of in order? So like you start with one family, let's say the Gambinos, and you go like from the beginning all the way to the end and then go to the next. And I was thinking like, no, because I feel like there needs to be some sort of like, ability of the listener to kind of be able to connect it all.
Mm-hmm. And what we're doing with this show, Jeff, is we're assembling a 10,000 piece puzzle, right? Yeah. And it's like every piece that gets connected, you remember a little bit of a callback to a prior episode. We say, oh, I remember that guy. you know, and it, you, I think it helps to kind of build the listener's knowledge base, right? Because you're putting the pieces together yourself.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. So next week we'll have another great show. I think next week we're going to probably do Frank Matthews. And that's going to be obviously a lot different than this week, but you know, and I don't know how much you know about Frank Matthews, but you know, I love talking about Frank because Frank is the biggest drug trafficker in the history of America that no one's heard about. I think he has probably the most, one of the more fascinating stories you'll ever hear about that you haven't heard about. Do you know who Frank Matthews is, Blackjack?
Black Caesar.
Yeah. So you do. So, and I know you do. So, and we'll kind of connect it to obviously the Black Mafia and Black crime. But, you know, Frank, there's no comparison when it comes to American. There was no bigger drug deal. You can talk about fucking that rat Nicky Barnes and rat Frank Lucas and Bumpy and all these people, but Frank Matthews literally was on top of all of them. And we're going to talk about him and we're going to go through it because I think people need to know who Frank Matthews is, and he's truly fascinating and, you know, might still be out there somewhere. So we'll talk about that next week. Thanks for listening. I am Jeff Nadeau. He's Blackjack Fletcher. Thank you to our sponsors, Thrive Fantasy and OmertaMia.com. Go check out OmertaMia. Use promo code SITDOWN20 to get your discount. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week here on the Sit Down Unorganized Roundup.